Hey, what's going on? It's At The Letters for Wednesday, February 22nd. Arden Zwelling here with Ben Nicholson Smith. Our producer is Christian Ryan. You can email us at theletters@sportsnet.ca. You can like, share, favorite, subscribe, all those good things, wherever you get your podcasts. And starting this week back on YouTube, so you can check us out there. Ben, spring training is full go now. We got full squad workouts. Everybody is doing what they gotta do to get ready for the season. That includes us in the media sphere. We're up to our old tricks, right? Like, this guy's made all of his adjustments and it's gonna be different this year, and that guy's in the best shape of his life, and we're going back over all the old tropes that we reliably go to at this time of year. The one thing I feel like we don't do enough of at this time of year, though, is challenge our assumptions. And I think back to this time last year when the Blue Jays are ramping up for the regular season. We're pretty sure Jose Berríos is going to start opening day, and he did end up starting opening day, and he's coming off of this basically half decade of incredibly consistent and durable high level big league starting pitching, and he's got his fresh extension, and we're all thinking, well, why would anything else happen in 2022? Like, why would things go any differently? We just permanent markered him in for another like 170, 180 innings of a 3.5 ERA. Lo and behold, things didn't go that way at all. So it's like a handy reminder right now as we enter 2023, and Jose Berríos is not going to be the opening day starter. He's going to be like the Blue Jays number four starter, that we really need to challenge our assumptions going into a season and not be too certain that anything is going to happen.
Yeah, baseball is incredibly unpredictable. And Jose Berríos, one of the many examples of that last year. I mean, there are countless examples, both on the positive and negative side of the ledger. But yeah, I mean, there's no question. It's, you know, even the guys who are the most predictable, at a certain point, they stop being predictable. So at a certain point, they decline, they get hurt. It happens to everybody. So everyone is just trying to make their best estimated guess at this point and set themselves up with as much depth as possible going into a season. And the Jays, no exception to that.
Jose Berríos, literally the worst ERA of any qualified starter in baseball last year, allowed the most hits of any pitcher in baseball, allowed the most earned runs of any pitcher in baseball last year, 100 earned runs. Quite a departure from the guy that he was over his time with the Minnesota Twins, when he's a multiple-time All-Star, just churning out seasons of 32 starts and like 3.5, 3.6 ERAs. Where's your confidence level that he can be that guy again? And then that track record suggests that 2022 was more of an aberration than a new trend.
Well, I do think he's ready for a bounce back. I do think it's fair to expect that Berríos will be better in 2023 than he was last year. He set the bar pretty low. I mean, as far as starting pitchers who actually took the ball with the frequency that Berríos did, as you said, like, he was ineffective. And it's not just the ERA. You know, there's some BABIP in there, and the Jays' improved defense could help him going into this coming season. He's a guy who does allow his share of fly balls, so the outfield defense could help him. But, you know, it's not fair to just blame the results in 2022 on the outfield defense. I mean, you look at how hitters squared up his fastball last season. They were on it all season long. The four-seam fastball, hitters hit .349 against it. They slugged .618 against it. You know, those are MVP numbers against his primary pitch. So it's not a good situation to be in. And a lot of that was command of the pitches. You know, you look at the velocity, it wasn't huge drop-offs. The movement, to some extent, was there. You talk to the people around the team, Pete Walker, Berríos himself. It was a confusing season for them to go through and try to find it. They've worked on some different things this spring, as Shai has written about down in Dunedin. So there are some tweaks that they can make. But, you know, fundamentally, he's got to be more effective with the fastball. The curveball, the changeup, those are big pitches for him, always have been. And I think he can do it. I think you look at the track record of 28-year-old pitchers who are multi-time All-Stars, they don't just fall off a cliff. So I do think better things are ahead. But, you know, for a guy whose strikeout rate fell off this past season and whose fastball was ineffective, I'm not just going to snap my fingers and say he's a guaranteed all-star either.
I think it was a bit of a double-barreled thing for Jose Berríos last year, and part of it was tipping. So part of it was that I think some teams knew what, like, when Jose Berríos was throwing a breaking ball and when he was throwing a fastball. And then I think the other half of it is that when he was throwing those fastballs that some teams had a very good idea were coming, he was just leaving them all over the heart of the plate. He was leaving them in really bad spots for him and really good spots for hitters. So I think it was like both of those things in concert with one another. And you could just go back and look at some of the game logs and see the teams that had something on him. The Cleveland Guardians, for one, like, stick out to me as a team that had a really good understanding of when Jose Berríos was going to throw certain pitches. You look at two of his outings against the Guardians last year, he had six swinging strikes across both of the outings. So across 8 2/3 innings, like, six swinging strikes in one outing for Jose Berríos would be underwhelming against any team, right? Like, that would be like, wow, I guess he just didn't have his best stuff that day. For him to have six swinging strikes across two outings that went nearly nine innings, like, that tells you something. And you can even go back and kind of look at it a bit more granularly in those games and just look at some of the takes and look at some of the stuff that Cleveland hitters were laying off of. So I think there were times there where Berríos was tipping, and then, yeah, the location with the fastball was just really unideal. And, like, credit to Berríos for constantly trying to figure it out throughout the season. The guy moved on the rubber a million times and tried a ton of different things with his delivery, moved his hands up, moved them down, like, did things with his hip and his glove and all sorts of stuff to not only combat the tipping but also try to find a more consistent release point. And you can kind of look at his release point throughout the year, and it was all over the place. And some of that is due to moving on the mound and, like, physically being in a different spot on the rubber that he's releasing from. But some of it as well was that his mechanics were just inconsistent. I think a really big thing for him this year is just going to be finding an approach that he can stick to, and maybe not tinkering as much, not trying one thing this start and another thing the next, and getting into this cycle where he's overthinking and it's bleeding into his psyche on the mound. I think it would be really important for him to just find something consistent that he's going to stick to mechanically and approach wise, sequencing wise, the way he's tunneling his pitches, the lanes that he's working in, all that stuff. I think it's going to be really important for him to just have a real consistent thrust as the season begins. And then the hope for him and Pete Walker has to be that he gets off on the right foot and can kind of build off that momentum.
Yeah, and I think, you know, he's pretty clearly a guy who has the skills. He's got the ability with his pitches, even with his fielding, great fielding pitcher. You know, obviously he's been through a lot, so he's not going to be rattled easily on the mound. A lot going on there for Berríos, and still very much young, very much in his prime. So I think that, you know, he can very easily be a 2-2.5 war player for the Jays. You know, maybe that ERA sits around 4. That's totally fine. That's still an incredibly useful pitcher. And in this rotation too, depending on what Gausman and Manoah do, depending on how Chris Bassett does in his first season as a Jay, like, that could be your number 4 starter. So as much as, you know, last year this time he was viewed more maybe as an ace, maybe as a number 2 starter, certainly there would be a hope that Berríos could be a playoff starter for this team as they move ahead here. But I don't think he has to be like a clear number 1. If he's a 3 on this team, if he's a 4, I think that's okay. You just want someone who's fastball is more effective than it was last year. Like, you can't be getting lit up to that extent if you're going to be a playoff caliber starter in the major leagues.
There he goes again. Cutter on and missed. The curveball gets Starris. Good job by Berríos as he strikes out the end of the inning.
And if he has the season that you're describing as the Blue Jays number 4, I mean, yeah, you're over the moon if you're the Blue Jays. But then you were just making the same mistake that you made last year by not challenging your assumptions and by saying that Alek Manoah and Kevin Gausman are going to be exactly what they were last season and Chris Bassett's going to be exactly what he's been for a couple of seasons. Like, are you not just making that same mistake that you made a year ago when, like, what reason in the world would you have to doubt that Jose Berríos wasn't going to keep doing what he'd just done for the last half decade? Are you not making that same mistake with a Manoah, with a Gausman, and then a Bassett in front of him?
And the reality is there's just a huge range of possibilities when it comes to how this Jays rotation can look. And of course, you know, if you're a Jays fan, you probably gravitate more toward the optimistic end of that spectrum. And you think, okay, Manoah's here. You know, he's going to stay at the top of this rotation. Gosman's a lock to be, you know, a number two starter, maybe a number one starter. I actually think there's upside for Gosman beyond what he did last year. When you look at his BABIP and you look at the Jays' improved defense, like he could actually take a step forward. But on the other side of things, there could also be a PFP where, you know, two of these guys are fielding a pop-up and they converge and boom, you know, like that's, we don't like to sit here and discuss those possibilities, but they happen too. And, you know, as we've seen it with the Yankees, they've had Montas go down. They've seen Nestor Cortes deal with some health issues already. We're just early in the stages of the Jays camp and stuff will happen in Dunedin, Florida as well. So you're right to say that you can't sit here and assume that things are going to go a certain way.
Here's the other thing that we do annually at this time of year, and that is sitting back and spending way too much time teasing what the batting order is going to be for the club and saying like, yeah, it's just going to, they're just going to line it up like this. And this is exactly what it'll be against lefties. This is exactly what it'll be against righties, of course. And yes, like if you're having fun with this stuff, like have fun with it, enjoy the game, however you want to enjoy it. But I do think it's worth pointing out that the Blue Jays used 147 different batting orders last year. That's 90% of their games that they had a unique batting order in. They had 8 different leadoff hitters, 9 different cleanup hitters, 10 different number 5 hitters throughout the course of the season. So often, your batting order on any given night is dependent on who's healthy, who's carrying something, they got to be in the DH spot, who is positionally limited, what's the matchup that you like against the starter on the other side. Oh, they scratched him and, you know, now they're going with opener and a guy. How do we want to adjust to this? Who's hot? Who's slumping? Who just psychologically, even mentally, needs a day and just needs a breather from competition? There is so much more that goes into batting orders throughout the season than just sitting here on February 22nd and saying they're going to line them up like this, 1 through 9, and that's what it's going to be.
Yeah, there's really no such thing as a batting order. I looked up that same baseball reference page. That's where I get it. I don't know where you found that number. But, you know, it's always a good reminder to check that list of all the different lineups. And it's just like it's all over the place, right? The names are sliding left and right. There is no consistent batting order. And that's not an aberration. It's not a product of, you know, a team that maybe made some trades or had some injuries. That's just the norm. That's how Major League Baseball works. And I think it even extends beyond the batting order. Like there's no such thing now as even a 5-man rotation, really. The Jays will go into the season with 5, but I bet that someone will make a spot start early in the season. Maybe it's Mitch White. Maybe it's someone who's called up. You've got doubleheaders in there. You think about guys like Ryu, who often would pitch on 5 days rest. His former teammate in LA, Clayton Kershaw, often pitches now on 5 days rest. Shohei Ohtani often pitches once a week. So it's really common for teams to deploy different configurations. And they do it because pitchers benefit from that. And you don't want to just tie yourself to, you know, this simplistic 5-man rotation or this simplistic 1 through 9. You want to stay as flexible as possible. And so when the season gets going and, you know, we're in there with John Schneider discussing these things on a day-to-day basis, you know, you can kind of look ahead a couple days. With the rotation, you're looking ahead maybe a turn, maybe 2 turns. With the starting lineup, you kind of look ahead a few days at a time because of the catchers, how that's going to affect your DH, what opposing pitchers are ahead on the schedule. But my sense is they build out lineups like 1, 2, 3 days ahead of time. But you're not thinking really more than that. And that's what leads to these lineups where you have in the course of a year 150, you know, different lineups on a good team.
Yeah, we it's such a misnomer, the number 5 starter competition, right? Because what really matters is like who's your 6, who's your 7, who's your 8. Like that's why I was making the case last week for the Blue Jays to see if there's a minor league deal to be had for like a Chris Archer or Dylan Bundy or Mike Minor or somebody, just to build out that depth a bit longer, because like Drew Hutchison is really high on the old depth chart right now. So you know, throughout spring we'll say, is it going to be Mitch White? Like, is it going to be Yusei Kikuchi the number 5 spot? What it really is like, let's think about that, like like midweek matinee against the Royals when you scratch a starter and someone else is on the IL and the other guy pitched 2 days ago in relief and extras, so you can't use him. And now it's the bullpen day started by like Matt Peacock. Like that's the one. Like, that's the contingency that we should be talking about is, you know, when it comes time to test your depth, and time will come to test depth with the Toronto Blue Jays, how is that going to look and how is that depth going to hold up? I think going into the season, you feel a lot better about the depth on the position player side than you have in recent years. But I think on the starting pitching side, there still is, you know, reason for trepidation with how much you would trust it going into the season.
Right. And you know, I'm sure that Mitch White is thinking that he's in a competition. And for the players themselves, if you're battling for that last spot on the bench, you know, an Otto Lopez, or maybe you're Whit Merrifield trying to show that you deserve everyday playing time. Maybe from their perspective, there is a real aspect of, hey, I'm fighting for my spot in the lineup. I'm fighting for my spot in the rotation. But, you know, I really think that, you know, you talk to executives, you talk to coaches who make these decisions, they love having the depth of options. It's never a bad thing to have more good options. And so the best case for any team is always to have tons of guys perform really well. And then you're choosing from a position of strength as you go into the games that count.
So that said, like, let me give you my sort of four pillars of batting order construction. I want to hear what you think about each of them. And this is ranked in order of what I think is most important. So when you're setting a batting order on, you know, a night-to-night basis throughout the regular season, number one, most important thing, in my opinion, who are your best hitters? Who are your 3 to 4 best hitters? Put them at the top because you want them getting as the most plate appearances as possible. Each batting order position receives like around 2.5-3% more plate appearances over the course of a season than the one below it. So as much as I am going to have some consistency on a night-to-night basis in my batting order, I want my best hitters, and for the Blue Jays, that is Springer, Vlad, Beau. I want them up top on a nightly basis so that over the course of the season, those are the guys that are getting the most plate appearances. Are you with me on that one?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's why you line it up. You want your best hitters coming up. You know, that bottom of the ninth, that top of the ninth, a few guys are getting an extra turn to hit. You do not want Vlad Guerrero Jr. on deck when you have, you know, Whit Merrifield, who's maybe definitely a faster runner, maybe a more traditional number one or two hitter. You don't want him at the plate. You want it to be Vlad Jr. And I'd toss Kirk into that group too, as far as the top hitters on the Jays.
There's some contact. Deep left field. It is gone.
Why not add to your all-star total Alejandro Kirk? Atta baby. Home run.
And I don't care if they're all right-handed. And I don't care if they all have a similar approach. Like, I'm not breaking those three up, like Vlad, Beau, Springer, for the sake of getting a lefty in there or getting a different look in there. I don't care if my top 3 to 4 hitters are all similar because they're all really good.
Right. Just in the same way that it's not a bad thing if you have 4 power hitters or if you have 4 Ichiros. I mean, like, that would be awesome. It's never happened because you just can't find 4 Ichiros. But if you lined up like Ichiro, Tony Gwynn, Luis Arias, and like, I don't know, another high average, low power hitter, that would be a good lineup. There would be no problem there. Like, you'd be in good shape. So the diversity at the top of the lineup as far as hitting approaches, maybe it's a nice to have. Certainly it makes it harder on opposing managers if there is that diversity of, you know, approach, of handedness, but, you know, end of the day, it's really, you're kind of stacking it by WRC+. I mean, that's yep. Really what you want to be doing at the top.
That's what I'm doing from my uninformed position, not making these decisions. Number two, and this is somewhat related to the first one, manage the first inning. Because when you think about it, the first inning is the only inning that you can truly control in the course of a game. You know exactly which pitcher you're going to be facing, and you can control exactly who you send up to face him. You're not going to have that luxury for the rest of the game. You don't have that level of control over who they are throwing and who's coming up for you, but you do have it in the first inning. And the other thing about the first inning is that that is traditionally the highest scoring inning of any inning in the game. The first inning is a leverage inning. We think of the eighth, the ninth as leverage innings. The first inning is absolutely a leverage inning. Last season, Hitters league-wide had a 728 OPS in the first inning. In the second inning, it was 679. That is nearly a 50-point drop-off. You can look at innings 7 to 9, which we think of as like the, you know, the point of the game that's the most dramatic, most consequential. This is when game-changing things happen. The OPS league-wide in innings 7 to 9 last year was 684. 728 in the first. That's a 44-point drop-off. The majority of run scoring in this game happens in innings 1 through 6. And like the loud run scoring, the home runs often happen in the first inning. Last year, 657 homers hit in the first. Only 532 hit in the second. That's 125 fewer. And it makes sense, right? Hitters are their freshest. They're their most locked in. They've been thinking about this starting pitcher all afternoon. They know what he throws. They know what to expect from him. Hitters also have like the highest level of mental alertness. They're their freshest. They have been standing around on defense. And also, what do starting pitchers do early in games? They try to establish their fastballs. Fastball percentage is at its highest in the first inning. So as a hitter, you have your best odds of getting a fastball that you can hit over the wall. That's why I think it's so important to manage the first inning and have your best hitters coming to the plate in that spot.
And I think it becomes self-fulfilling then too, because, you know, because teams bring their best hitters up, then we end up seeing the best hitters bat early in the game. They produce a lot better than your 7 through 9 hitters. And then that becomes an inning where we see a lot of offensive output because the pitchers are more challenged. It's a bigger challenge to face those hitters. And so that's reflected, I think, in the OPS. But yeah, I think, you know, when you say manage that inning, like, you know, aside from stacking it, is there anything tactical that you think teams can do there?
I think you'd be more aggressive because pitchers are more likely to throw their fastballs. Like we've seen this, fastball percentage is the highest earlier in outings for starters. Guys don't go out like, let me establish my slider. Let me establish my changeup. They try to establish their fastball. It's like data tells us this, that typically pitchers throw the most fastballs in the first inning. So be aggressive. Like be aggressive from the first pitch of the game. Like I think that it is frustrating for a lot of people when they see like the first inning and three hitters get out on 7 pitches or something. But if they're all swinging at fastballs in the zone, if they're making good swing decisions, good pitches to drive, and for whatever reason they just mishit them or it goes right at a guy or whatever happens, I'm okay with that. I can live with that because you made a good decision and you attacked a good pitch to hit.
No, for sure. I think there's a lot of reason to be aggressive if you know the fastballs are coming. Get up there and see if you can make some good contact. And definitely the Jays have hitters capable of doing that. Listen to At the Letters ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime.
Number 3, do try to avoid pockets of similar hitters at the middle and bottom of your batting order. So up top, top four hitters, I don't care if they're all right-handed and they all have a similar approach, do break up like runs of righties, runs of lefties, runs of contact guys, runs of power guys towards the bottom, just to make it harder for opposition managers to match up with you in middle to late innings, to make their bullpen decisions that much harder. And also as a manager, and obviously every manager does this, but like have your options in mind for who you will be swapping in, whether it's pinch hitting, pinch running, like what sort of tactical deployment decisions you'll be making later on. Like have that in mind and have a really clear plan of if X, if they bring in this guy, or if Y, then Z, then A. This is what I'm going to do. Because like odds are you are not, and this is particularly the case of the Blue Jays, you are not pinch hitting for your top 5 hitters. For some teams, it might only be your top 3. For the Blue Jays, it's top 5. Some nights it might be top 6. But towards the bottom, 7, 8, 9, like those are the guys who you are pinch hitting for. So you want to have a real clear idea of your deployment plan. And I do think it makes it easier for you to find your way to those advantageous matchups if there is some variability towards the bottom.
Yeah, because if you have 2 of 3 even, and it's 2 lefties out of 3, 2 righties out of 3, the opposing manager brings in a reliever, then that reliever has to stay in for 3 batters. So then one of those hitters is going to get a platoon advantage in the course of that 3-batter run. And you're never going to avoid, you know, obviously in a group of 3, the most possible diversity you can have is 2 and 1. So you're never going to avoid that, you know, advantage for a reliever as he comes in to the game. But I do think that trying to avoid, you know, three in a row, if you're the Jays, there's no chance. I don't think there's any chance all season that we would see Belt, Varsho, Kiermaier stacked one at three in a row. I can't even imagine them doing that.
No. And number four for me is do not discount player comfort and what players are experiencing subjectively. We can sit here and we can objectively like say, well, you know, here is the like optimal batting lineup and here is, you know, where you want like somebody with a really good OBP and like here is what the data and information tells us. Like that's all really important. All that objective stuff is really important. But what a player is subjectively experiencing on a night-to-night basis, standing in that batter's box, is just as meaningful, if not more, to performance. Even if we can't plot it on a spreadsheet, even if I can't make a nice like little chart that I can throw into an article, like there is a human in that batter's box trying to execute at a high level. And if that human is uncomfortable with a certain batting order position for whatever reason, that's something you have to factor in. So if, say, and I'm just by way of example, if, say, Vladimir Guerrero Jr. is really uncomfortable hitting second in the lineup, like for whatever reason, you have to account for that and you have to factor that in and say, okay, maybe he's not going to hit second because I want him to be as comfortable as possible so that he can be as productive as possible when he's facing Gerrit Cole throwing 99. Like I have to take into account what he is experiencing psychologically because ultimately athletes will perform their best when they are most comfortable. And it is your job as a manager to put your athletes in the best possible position to succeed. So you want to understand like what those positions are and work to get your players into those positions or try to like identify whatever the block is about hitting in that particular position, whatever the block is about that number next to their name on the lineup card, and just work to remove that stress or that impediment or whatever it is that is making them feel a certain way or preventing them from feeling their best in a certain spot.
The human element is real for sure. You want those guys to be comfortable. To me, as you're looking at those calls, I think it probably functions best as a, let's say like an opt out. You know, if you have someone slotted into the two spot, you know, you can opt out. If you have someone batting ninth and they absolutely hate it, you know, maybe you think about that. Or, you know, let's say Whit Merrifield is in the lineup against Gerrit Cole and he comes to you and he says, I really just don't get a good look at the ball out of Gerrit Cole's hand. Okay, you're out of there. Espinal's in. Doesn't matter what the numbers say. Like, you can take yourself out of a spot. I don't think you can put yourself into one unless maybe Vlad Jr. can, you know, maybe a George Springer can have a little bit of impact. But, you know, if you're Kevin Biggio and you say, I'm really comfortable hitting second, well, you know, probably not going to happen. If you're Santiago Espinal and you say, I want to be the cleanup hitter for this team, I just feel so comfortable there. You know, I think there's probably a limit to it. I know you're not saying otherwise, but I think that as a way to sort of remove a player from a situation that's uncomfortable, 100%, that's got to be on the table.
This has been my batting order sermon, my batting order TED talk. These are things that I think are important. I'm not going to sit here and line up the Blue Jays 1-9, but I do think those are some of the factors that are most important. Anything else catching your eye at Blue Jays camp? Anything else on the tip of your tongue when it comes to this team right now?
Well, you know, I am looking forward to getting down there. It's less than a week now before I'll be down on the ground in Dunedin, and I know for you as well. And it's going to be great to be back there. I'm definitely excited to get my eyes on, you know, a lot of the new players and some of the prospects. It's a really good time to see, you know, even, for example, some of the top prospects in this organization are in Major League camp. So an Addison Barger, you've got a Ricky Tiedemann. I hope that the Jays challenge these guys and put them into games early in camp. They're probably not going to be up for that long necessarily. So in the early stages of camp, you want to find ways to get them in. And maybe it's innings 6-7 for Tiedemann. You know, maybe it's some late game at bats for someone like an Addison Barger. They're probably not going to be in the starting lineup, but I think it's a great chance. And I think if you're the Jays, you should actually push these guys and you should put them in the highest pressure situations you can. That, you know, there are limitations on that in spring training, of course, because the pressure's just not as high. But I think that this is a great chance to kind of further their development and exposure to high quality players, to some pressure, and to help them develop. So I'm curious to see, you know, guys like Tiedemann, Zulueta, of course, a lot of velo right there, see how much he can harness it. Addison Barger, of course, is someone, Spencer Horwitz, just to get a better sense of these guys and how close they are to being able to contribute in Toronto.
Yeah, Hagen Danner, another name I would add to that list. That's a guy who I thought was going to impact the Blue Jays last season because he was added to the 40-man like last winter and then came into April and was throwing the ball well and then just disappeared, like had an elbow issue and was gone for the rest of the season and then popped back up in the Arizona Fall League, like sit 98 power slider, like looked every bit a high leverage relief weapon. So I'd like to see him in some of those spots. And like, you're right, it is the time to challenge guys in those situations. Like, it's still Grapefruit League, right? The intensity is not quite going to be there. You're not going to have 40,000 people at the yard, and it's not going to be broadcast to millions and all that stuff, right? Like, it's just, there's not as much juice in it, but it is almost like a free look at some of your top prospects against high competition where you're not bringing them up in season and inserting them immediately into that pressureful situation. You're not starting anybody's service clock. Like, you're not selecting any contracts. You just get a free look at what these guys could look like, how they could perform and behave in those spots. And I think both club and player just benefit from that exposure.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you're not going to have the same intensity. You're not going to get the same benefit from doing a live BP against your teammates on a backfield. You're just not. It's not the same thing. And we saw that a couple springs ago with Alek Manoah when he went out against the Yankees, struck out 7 or 8 in a row, and really showed, okay, like, maybe he wasn't quite ready, although maybe he was with hindsight. And, you know, even regardless, that would have been an important step for him to see that his stuff plays and to see, all right, like, you're actually pretty close to the major leagues here. And the opposite would also be true, because if Ricky Tiedemann faces the, you know, Tigers one day and he allows 6 runs in an inning and a third and forgets to cover first base and, you know, loses track of the signs, then there will be a lot of lessons there too. And regardless of whether he's really ready and, you know, we're talking about him impacting the major league team in 6 weeks, or if he's really not ready and it's more like a September situation or even a 2024 situation for someone like Tiedemann, then you're going to learn something. He's going to learn something about himself, and the Jays will learn something about their own depth chart. And that's, I mean, really, that's a big part of spring, because as much as, you know, Tiedemann's an important part of the 2026 or 27 Blue Jays, but there's also a chance that he's an important part of the 2023 team.
Yeah, I would say, I mean, we'll see how his season goes, but it would not surprise me if he is healthy and he is performing through the first half of the season, if he's a factor in the second half with the Blue Jays. Like, I think that's really realistic for him. Obviously, he has to check those boxes of health and performance first, but I mean, stuff is stuff. I think pitchers can move really fast. We're seeing that kind of across the league. And I think Alek Manoah showed you something as well.
Yeah. And this team at this point, like, you know, obviously when Vlad Jr. debuted, there was a, in my opinion, a justified discussion about whether service time manipulation was taking place. And, you know, I think that it was justified at the time. I also think Vlad Jr. was far from a finished product at the time, as we saw from a defense and base running standpoint. But, you know, whatever questions existed then on a losing team with very little prospects of doing anything, they've been erased. And I think it's pretty clear when you look at the recent track record that the Jays are going to try to field the best 26-man roster possible. And the service clock stuff, you know, maybe I'll be proven wrong. If he has a 1 ERA in August and he's sitting there in AAA, then we'll change the tone of this discussion. But my expectation is they'll call him up as soon as they think he's ready.
A couple small things to run by you. Number one, Robbie Grossman signs with the Texas Rangers. You know, he looked like a pretty good fit for the end of the Blue Jays bench, but there's going to be a lot more playing opportunity for him with where he is going. Do you think the Blue Jays are one bench piece away? Like, do you still think there is another move to come to round out this roster?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know whether it comes in, like, it might be July 30th that move happens. And I think it's actually fine if it does happen July 30th. At the same time, you know, if they can do it sooner, then that's great. And there are often small deals to be had toward the end of spring training. And Grossman would have been great, you're right. But I think at the same time, you know, at the risk of like oversimplifying things, we're talking about an outfielder, not even a center fielder, who bats right-handed. You know, like this is you can find this in Major League Baseball. You want someone who mashes lefties, who can play a corner outfield. This is an achievable goal. So I don't think that there's any reason to panic. There's lots of possibility for signing a free agent, you know, someone who's been released toward the end of spring, opts out of a deal. You can do that on April the 5th. You can do that in a trade on March the 27th. You can see what you have in Otto Lopez and Nathan Lucas and make it work. So I don't think there's a ton of reason to panic here, because ultimately there are a lot of guys who can on paper fill that role.
1,000%. This is the sort of thing that is going to be dealt with at the end of March. Remember back to just last year, when it was the very end of camp that the Blue Jays flipped Reese McGuire for Zach Collins. Same thing with for Zimmer. I think it was Anthony Castro, right? For Bradley Zimmer, to add him, because look, with Zimmer, with Collins, the clubs that they had that they were with didn't want to DFA them. Like they opened up trade discussions with clubs to see if they could get something back for those players. And lo and behold, they did. Like they found a fit for those players. And some of that was based off of discussions that I'm sure began in the off season and known interest that the Blue Jays had in those players. So that sort of stuff is going to happen towards the end of spring. There will be those similar opportunities for little deals around the margin like that. Like you said, there'll be players that end up on waivers that you could bring in. The Blue Jays have the flexibility to open a couple of 40-man roster spots by moving Hyunjin Ryu and Chad Green to the 60-day IL. They haven't done either of those things yet. So the Blue Jays have that flexibility to create that opening if someone ends up on waivers. So I think that you can anticipate something like that happening. And I also think we are like doing yet another rite of spring, as I was kind of mentioning earlier, with like not challenging assumptions and like spending way too much time on the batting order. We are now spending way too much time discussing the 26th man on the roster, like the out of options, end of bench, like you said, right? You know, outfielder who is barely going to play and only come in to pinch hit against a lefty or against a righty guy. Remember the Greg Bird thing last spring? Remember all that, right? Remember how much noise there was around Greg Bird all spring because he was raking, right? Like credit to him. He probably played a dozen games and hit a bunch of homers and had 1,000 OPS. Like good for him, right? And there was a lot of buzz that he was going to earn a bench role. And he was actually informed late in camp that he wasn't. He wasn't going to be coming north with the team and that he had a decision to make. And then he made that decision and he opted out of his deal. The Blue Jays thought they were going to retain him at the time to go to Buffalo. And lo and behold, here come the New York Yankees with a better offer or a better opportunity at least, and he goes to the Yankees and uproar and outrage, and how could he possibly, what's going on, was he a spy for the Yankees, what is this all about? Greg Bird got released halfway through the AAA season. He had like an 84 weighted runs created plus at AAA and got released and didn't play again last year. So just keep that in mind as well, the mistakes we make at this time of year.
Yeah, I mean, it's always intriguing to like see how those storylines play out. And a lot of the time, we don't necessarily follow up with them. I shouted out Ghost K. Cato last week, of course. And, you know, he ended up bouncing around in a couple waiver claims. And yeah, there's always some buzz around some of these guys. But it is just, it's such a long season. And so you're going to need help from, you know, literally dozens of players who don't break camp with the Blue Jays will put on a Toronto Blue Jays uniform this year. And some of them will actually make really big contributions. So, you know, it's not to say that all of these unheralded players end up, you know, completely on the margins, completely forgotten, because some of them do make a big impact. But, you know, it's tough to do as the 26th man on the roster to be that memorable performer. And, you know, certainly the Jays have time to figure out what that's going to look like.
So let me like contradict myself, break my own rule and major in a minor here as we wrap up the first half. And because this is just one thing with this roster that did occur to me the other day, and I kind of wonder where it's heading. The lack of optionable relievers at the end of the bullpen. You look at the Blue Jays bullpen, right? Jordan Romano, Eric Swanson, Anthony Bass, Jimmy Garcia. locks. Those guys are there if they're healthy. Tim Mayza and Adam Simber, I would put as like a 5-6, yep. And then Trevor Richards and Mitch White towards the end. There's your eight, assuming you say Kikuchi's in the rotation. Trevor Richards and Mitch White, the two guys at the end, both out of options. Adam Simber and Tim Mayza do have options, but would you? Would you option no. those guys? And then you've got the back end of your bullpen beyond that. Bass, Garcia, Swanson, Romano. So the Blue Jays don't have an obvious optionable guy in their bullpen. And we know a bullpen is a live thing, a fluid thing. At some point over that long road trip that the Blue Jays open the season on, they're going to have to make a move because they're going to, you know, have played a 12-inning game, or they're going to have had a short start and burned through a bunch of guys, and they just need somebody to cover innings. They're going to have to make a move at some point. Does something kind of have to give? Do the Blue Jays almost have to find a way to get an optionable arm into their bullpen so they have that flexibility?
So, okay, I'm thinking, so, okay, first of all, rules-wise, 13 is a hard cap on pitchers, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so five in the rotation, eight in the bullpen, you're done. So those eight you mentioned, that's where it really does get capped. Now, the simplest answer for me is one of those guys will start the season on the IL and someone else will be up, and then that guy will be optioned. And from there, you just kind of churn. And then there's, you know, someone comes on the IL or back from the IL, someone else goes on. You know, maybe it's a starting pitcher who goes on the IL, Mitch White transitions to the rotation, someone else comes back into the bullpen. So that's the simplest answer to me, but it's an interesting point. And, you know, I hadn't really considered it or looked at it that way, because I think the ideal configuration, I mean, ideal is they're all optionable. But I think, you know, a more realistic configuration for a contending team is probably to have two optionable relievers, something like that. And you can churn those guys within the limits that now exist and create a little bit of, you know, just freshness in the bullpen.
Yeah, it is something that occurred to me, but it is also definitely something that is going to work itself out without doubt as we charge towards opening day. We're going to step away, but there's plenty more to talk about when we continue on At the Letters. It continues on At the Letters. Arden Swelling here with Ben Nicholson-Smith and our producer, Christian Ryan. You can email us at theletters@sportsnet.ca. It's been great hearing from you this year. We are responding to those emails, and we're going to be getting to a bunch of them on the podcast throughout the season. So I got a cool one from Leicester, England. They want to get to. Always good to hear from international listeners. This is from Martin Andrews in Leicester, and he says, "Hi, Arden and Ben. I would be really interested in hearing about what the players do on a day-to-day basis. The 162-game season is unlike any other sport. How long do they spend pregame in meetings, tactics, press, warm downs, massage, etc., etc.? Do they go home and back to do it all again on the road? Is it back to the hotel, eat, sleep, and report back next day? Also, the international series, do you think the MLB is serious about pushing the game globally? Keep up the good work. Go Jays." From Martin Andrews in Leicester, England. Thank you for the email, Martin. We're going to talk international baseball at some point, probably during the WBC. Got some WBC thoughts. I got some international baseball thoughts. But we were more interested in the first part of your question about player day-to-days, because it does actually relate a bit to a situation the Blue Jays are encountering right now with Alejandro Kirk, who is awaiting the birth of his child with his partner in Mexico and has yet to report to Blue Jays camp. And push is coming to shove a little bit with the amount of time that Kirk has missed from his day-to-day routine and from what he has to do at Blue Jays camp. He was always going to be behind because he's reporting late, but then there's also the wrinkle of him potentially playing for Mexico at the WBC in there and potentially having an absence from camp, sounding like it's unlikely that is going to happen now. But either way, Kirk has missed like some really valuable time at Blue Jays camp. And Ben, I think this is sort of related to Martin's question about just the importance of what players do on a daily basis at the park.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, thanks for the question from Martin, and thanks to everyone who sent in questions. It's been great to see those emails come in. Also, a lot of response on Twitter, which is great to see, and some new iTunes reviews, which are always welcome, especially if you decide that we're worthy of a 5-star review. So it's great to see all of that response, and definitely appreciate all of that from the listeners. Yeah, so, you know, with Kirk, where do you want to start? With Kirk or with the routines? What do we think here?
Well, let's just quickly touch on Kirk. Like, what is going on with this situation? What does the priority have to be with the Blue Jays here, with him not yet being in camp, WBC looming over all this, and what's important for him to be doing? Like, what's most important for Alejandro Kirk over the next 6 weeks?
Well, first of all, being there for the birth of his child, I think Absolutely. That's safe to say. So I'm sure, you know, at this point in the year, there shouldn't be really any issue with that. He's obviously away with the permission of the team, with the understanding that he's going to be there with his family. And that makes all the sense in the world for him to be there for that big moment. Now, second priority would seem to me to be the Toronto Blue Jays over Team Mexico. And you start to read some of the coverage from Florida around you know, comments that John Schneider's been making about Alejandro Kirk, and the simple fact of trying to get everyone ramped up. And as a catcher, he has to get familiar with new pitchers. It's guys like Swanson and Bassett who haven't worked with Kirk in the past and who really will benefit from developing some familiarity. So the Jays have obviously approved his decision to play for Team Mexico, but it sounds like they're starting to think about revoking that approval. And that to me seems like a totally reasonable response, because, you know, if you're the Blue Jays, like, yeah, great. You know, hopefully Mexico does well. Hopefully Kirk does well. But really, you know, they've got their own business to run. They've got their own team to try to get as many wins as possible. And so, you know, Kirk needs to be with the Blue Jays once he's done with, you know, his family and making sure that everything's gone well there.
I would say that what he's missing out on big time right now is habit and routine formation for the major league season. And that gets to some of what Martin was saying about the day-to-day, about the multitude of meetings and sessions that Alejandro Kirk would be having with Blue Jays starters and relievers, learning their repertoires, what they like to throw, their attack plans, what their focuses are, what they're trying to accomplish in spring games, and then into the regular season. Any kind of tweaks and adjustments and mechanical things, like someone like Danny Jansen, I've talked to him about it in the past, like he will remind pitchers of body cues when it comes to their deliveries, like in game. And so he has to know that stuff. Like if Jose Berríos is trying to keep his glove tighter to, you know, his front arm closed so that he's more directional to the plate and he's flying open a little bit, like Danny Jansen has to understand that that is something that he's working on, and he has to understand how to communicate that to him and notice it in game. And that comes from like a lot of time spent with the pitcher and a lot of those meetings and sessions that they would have in bullpens, in meeting rooms, even like when they're just having lunch and talking about baseball in the clubhouse, sitting at their lockers. So like that's Alejandro Kirk's missing a lot of that stuff. And to get back to like Martin's question, like that is a lot of what happens throughout spring training and the regular season as well. Like it is not an exaggeration to say that players like Alek Manoah and Bo Bichette and name your player are arriving at the Blue Jays player development complex in spring training at 5:30 a.m. every morning. Some of them might be closer to 6 or 6:30, but like the sun is not up when a lot of players get in, and they are arriving and they're changing into their, you know, clothes for the, like the baseball clothes that they're going to wear during the day. They're getting a bite to eat, a coffee. They're like getting some treatment. They're kind of getting activated, getting, you know, ready for the day, any kind of training room stuff they have to do. Some guys like to lift early in the day and get that out of the way. They're having meetings early on. They're, you know, and those meetings can be, you know, one-on-one, like I was saying, between Danny Jansen and the pitcher. They could be among the entire pitching staff. They could be among all the hitters with hitting coaches and strategists. They could be team-wide meetings. Like every day it's going to be a little bit different. And then they are sort of looking at their schedule for the day. And when do I have to be where? What bullpens do I have to catch? When am I hitting? That's the hardest thing for a catcher, is finding time to actually focus on your offensive side of the games. So like, when am I in the cages? When can I get a little time with Guillermo Martinez? When can I do some T work and some drill work? When can can I get into the recovery pool? Like, when can I get time with the massage therapist? Like, all this stuff is layered into a very long day at spring training that can start as early as 5:30 a.m. and stretch well into the late afternoon.
It's a long day for sure. I think to go back to Kirk for a second, like, to some extent, I believe it when I say that there's a lot of benefit to developing that familiarity and building those relationships. I do believe it. I think at the same time, I hear this, like, this voice in my head, this like devil's advocate voice that's kind of like, you know, we are sort of overcomplicating this, because when guys show up after the trade deadline, they have to get ready right away. They have to get used to each other with little to no warning, and they pull it off. You know, it's not like there are five pass balls every time there's a trade deadline acquisition. You know, they figure it out. So, you know, spring training is way too long to begin with. If Kirk is there for a month, he'll have plenty of time to build that familiarity with all the pitchers and be completely ready for opening day. And this is the kind of storyline we'll probably forget about in a month's time. But, you know, with that being said, I don't think you want to, you know, just have him depart for two of those 4 weeks. Like, 2 weeks probably is not enough, but 4 weeks is enough.
I would say that trade deadline scenario is significantly less than ideal and significantly less than optimal. And when you have the opportunity right now to control as many variables as you can, I think you want to do that.
Yeah.
It reminds me of, like, look, Jordan Romano was going to go to the WBC and pitch for Team Italy, and he's already dropped out of that. Like, he already reneged on that because, look, what would that have required of him? He would have had to travel literally around the globe. Like, what is the flight to Taiwan? Like, 18, 20 hours or something? That's where Italy's playing. Would have disrupted his entire body clock, would have had to, you know, acclimatize to life on the other side of the planet for a couple of weeks, disturb his sleep, disturb his training. Nutrition is uncertain in an unfamiliar environment. And then he has to go out into, like, really extremely intense and meaningful competition in a short tournament at a time when his body is not used to that level of competition, and actually push himself physically to throw 99 in the bottom of the ninth of the game on the line before like 20,000 people, against some really talented hitters from Cuba. And then who knows, maybe Italy wins and then he goes on to Tokyo to pitch like in an even more pressure-packed situation. Or maybe he's now reversing everything that he's just done, and he's coming home 2 weeks later, 24 hours back across the Pacific, like reversing his body clock again, reacclimating, getting back into his training and his nutrition routines and his habits. Like, it's just so disruptive to what you need to do as an MLB player, and that is like have a consistent routine day in and day out over 162. I really do think that is how players perform at their best, when their routines are consistent and habitual every single day. I think that's where like the WBC gets really problematic for certain guys. And I think that's where it's sort of problematic that Alejandro Kirk isn't, you know, really establishing those rhythms right now. They're going to carry him throughout the season.
It's so interesting though. And I wonder, you know, like how you make sense of this mentally, because, you know, for me, we go through it to some extent as well, because our schedules shift to the really early part of the day, right? Like, it's the clubhouse opens at 8 a.m. So you're up, you know, 6:30, whatever the case, which is, you know, definitely different than a 7 p.m. start, right? Like, that's a very different schedule for anyone in and around the team environment at that point. And so, you know, when you're talking about those 5 a.m. wake up calls, and I remember Alec Manoa, when we had him on ATL last spring, he was talking about getting to the facility really early, how important that was to him. Obviously it worked. Like, you know, the results are there. It was effective for him. But at the same time, I find it so weird, because routine is so important for these guys. And you go for this 6 week period, you're in this really early wake up cadence. Then all of a sudden it's like, oh, you show up to the ballpark, maybe 2 p.m. games at 7, you have time to do all of your meetings, your, you know, media availabilities, you're doing your stretching, you're watching video in a lot of cases. And so your clock is entirely shifted. These guys eat their last meal of the day at like 11 p.m. Whereas in spring training, they might have lunch at 10:30. Like, it's all over the map. And so it actually is not conducive to building routines.
No, and then the regular season is going to start, and they're going to play like mid-afternoon on opening day, and then they're going to play two like early afternoon games on the weekend in St. Louis, and then they're going to go to Kansas City and play night games, and they're going to have a matinee at the end of that series, and then they're going to immediately go to the West Coast, to Anaheim, and play at whatever time their body thinks it is. I guess the games there are probably like 6:30 local, but they're going to be all screwed up by the time that they get back to Toronto for opening day on April 11th against the Detroit Tigers, 7 p.m. start at Rogers Center. Yeah, who knows what time their body is going to think it's going to be. So they're going to be all over the map with, like you said, the spring training super early wake-ups in early games, and then a couple of night games towards the end of spring as well, and then going straight into that really grueling road trip to start the year.
Yeah, and whatever works for each individual player, okay, go for it. If the 5:30 a.m. works, then, do what makes sense. It's just, I find it honestly kind of puzzling, like why it takes place so early in the day. And obviously there's a lot of history to it. There's a lot of momentum to why they do it this way. It's, for one thing, it's not as hot as it gets in the afternoon in Florida, where it can get extremely hot. So there is a weather environmental factor to all of this. But yeah, I don't know. Like it would seem to me that, 9 to noon range might be really good for getting some of that same stuff done.
I think it's just sort of a natural progression from the off season. Like every player that I've talked to about their off season training, like always trains early in the morning. Like they always get all their work done really, really early. Like Marcus Semien was that way. Like he would, and there was the off season before he came to the Blue Jays. He was actually working out at the Coliseum when he wasn't an Oakland Athletic anymore. He was a free agent, but like he meant so much to that franchise that they let him continue to work out there. And yeah,
plus the facility is so nice. I mean, how could you resist as a player? Easy to see why.
I think it was very convenient and familiar for him. I think that was the reason for that. And remember, like he grew up in the Bay Area too, right? So he's lived there his entire life. So there's something there. I agree. Like it's probably not the most modern facility. I think he made quite a jump when he was in Dunedin at the brand new player development complex. But look, he was still working out there, and he was like getting there at 4:35 in the morning. And like throwing, 4 plates on the squat rack, like, let's go. It's like, and most players I've talked to have been in that rhythm during the off season. And I get it, man. Like during my off season, I tend to wake up super early. Like I move into that sort of routine just naturally, body clock wise, even though during the regular season, like I'm frequently leaving the Rogers Center at 12:30 a.m., 1 a.m., whatever. Yeah. And catching a flight the next day at 6 a.m. and not sleeping, and my body clock's all screwed up. I'm all over the place. I'm in this like rhythm of night games. Even though I do that for 6, 7, 8 months during the regular season, during the off season, I just naturally revert to like being an early riser and getting workouts done early in the day. So I can see why athletes are like that. So maybe it just make it a little bit easier to have spring training just be a continuation of that off season rhythm when guys are up earlier.
For sure. And I can see the appeal going into spring that you might want to continue that rhythm. And then it creates this big shift when opening day comes and all of a sudden you're playing night games. So, it's one of the many adjustments. These guys, they are very, very adept at making adjustments. They get traded. They have to produce the next day. They get, different environments. Fans are in the stands. Now they're not. Now they're back again. Like, the environment is... they're very good at tuning out outside factors and finding ways to produce. It's one of the distinguishing factors, one of the real skills that these major league players have, aside from the hand-eye coordination, aside from the strength and the speed, you really do have to be able to adapt to the circumstances you're placed in.
I do think that improving recovery, improving sleep, is probably one of the biggest opportunities for major league clubs to get more out of their players throughout the course of the season. But I also do think that like a 162 game schedule with varying start times from day to day and off days some weeks and not others and cross continent flights. And look, it's not as bad for the Blue Jays as it is for like the Angels, right? As it is for Mariners. All those West Coast teams, Mariners, that a more balanced schedule is like great for the Blue Jays in terms of the competitiveness of some of the clubs they're going to be playing. It's not so great for the travel schedules of some of those West Coast teams that are now going to be like taking way more flights to the east side of the continent. I mean, it's going to be a real burden for them. It's really going to disrupt sleep. So I do think like every club is doing a lot to try to find ways to give their players more time to rest, to recover, to sleep properly, because it's a massive opportunity when it comes to preventing injuries and getting more out of performance. But I also think that just the grind and the schedule of a 162 game baseball season is going to be forever in opposition to maximizing that.
Yeah, exactly. You're not going to maximize your rest by playing a Major League Baseball schedule. It's just not possible. I do think, you know, as you say, there is some opportunity there. And as we saw at the Jays Player Development Complex in Florida, they do have some sleep rooms. They do have some spots where players can grab a little bit of rest. So that's a good thing, you know, for those in the 5:30 a.m. club, and maybe they need a little way to grab back a little bit of rest later in the day.
And that gets back to Martin's question, just to put like a cap on it. Like, players have very strict routines throughout the day during the regular season for a 7 o'clock start. A lot of guys will be turning up to the ballpark around noon, around 1 o'clock, because they've got a lot of stuff they want to do ahead of a game. And sometimes that includes a nap. Like, there's a lot of players who take naps around, you know, whatever. It could be 2 p.m., could be 6 p.m. right before the game. Like, guys have their times where they go into that sleep room or they find their quiet place in the clubhouse and they steal 20 minutes of sleep, and they legitimately have like a blackout mask and noise canceling headphones and everything that they put on because that's just part of their routine. So to answer Martin's question, everything happens at the ballpark and it is a very long and involved process every single day. And the major league season is an insane grind that I still really struggle to communicate just how challenging it is to people. Because unless you're up close to it and or living it as the players are, it can just be really hard to comprehend.
Yeah, it's a lot. There are so many little nuances to it. We could do a whole podcast. We could probably do a podcast mini series on the whole behind the scenes of, you know, what goes into a day. And hopefully we'll convey some of that as the season unfolds. But yeah, it's a long day. They show up early, they stay late, and basically, you know, they have excellent, excellent care. They have meals that are catered for them. They have massage therapists, physical therapists, mental skills coaches. So they have a lot of resources there, which is part of the reason that the players spend a lot of time in that environment.
No doubt about that. That's going to be it for us this week on At The Letters. Want to thank you as always for listening. Want to thank our producers, Christian, Ryan, and Nick Ondrod, who is doing the video this week and throughout the season. You can catch us on video now or just continue to listen to us wherever you get your podcasts, and we'll keep pumping them out. So for Ben Nixon Smith, my name's Arden Zwelling. Talk to you next time on At The Letters.